This is 5 of 7, Part B of a Child Guidance Series by Frank Phillips. Feel free to copy and share with others.
Okay, it seems terrible to quit the other part, but still we do need to cover these questions, so we'll start. And the section we're going to start on first is spiritual life. And these are all the questions that were turned in on spiritual life, and I'll read them, and then we'll discuss them one by one. How do you teach children righteousness by faith when everything we tell them is go to church, do this, do that, and so forth, because Jesus wants us to? Question 2, teaching children to pray, how to do that. 3, guiding their personal experience with God. 4, child spiritual development, how to. 5, I am overwhelmed with the way society gears everything to thrilling and pleasing the self, life, and the child. How do we go about teaching the child that everything revolves about Christ, around Christ living in us? A child is born thinking and caring only about himself. How do we help him to understand dying to self? It seems so difficult, too, for us as adults to change our thinking. Is there some way to prevent their having to go through this? Can we help them to grow up understanding the Christ-centered life rather than them finding it such a total change of thinking? So it's quite a broad scope here of questions. Maybe we just ought to take them kind of one by one. In this book, Child Guidance, pages 494 to 499 and 512 to 514, is right on this subject. That is just, I don't know any place we could read anything any better than that. And maybe if we have our books, we could, you know, spot some good things in this section here. But for this first question, how do you teach children righteousness by faith when everything we tell them is go to church, do this, and so forth, because Jesus wants us to? In other words, I think this person wants us to have a better reason for telling children to do this than Jesus wants us to. And how do we do this? Susan, you're loaded with ideas on this.
Well, why don't they bother
to take some way and let their
children listen to it? We just finished it.
Mm-hmm.
That was one I
wanted
to
suggest. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, if children are brought up, and of course it's through the book here too, that if children are brought up with this great love for Jesus, because their parents have this great love for Jesus, and they see him, they see their parents going to church and living up to the, you know, the standards of the church and the things that the denomination teaches, not because if I do it somehow I'll make it to heaven, but if they see parents doing this, because we love the Lord so much, we want to do what Jesus wants us to do. Seems like it would come kind of natural to
America. Mm-hmm.
Out of the home.
It's part of our, you know, it's part of our life.
This is what life is all about.
Naturally, your life is all life.
Well,
maybe they got older and I don't know what age and
Alan?
Well, maybe I understand, but I can't think of a better reason than Jesus wants me to.
Except that I love Jesus. That would be the better reason.
You see, really, this is, again, something that is caught and not taught. Really, if the Sabbath is the high day of our family life, if the Sabbath is a day when we wait from sundown to sundown,
To do
the things that really our family life surrounds, then we're in trouble. But if the Sabbath day is actually a real delight to us, I mean, it's a real pleasure to us, not that you crawl in bed and, you know, sleep, because that's the most boring thing that a child can think of, you know, I mean. But if actually the Sabbath day isn't always a rest day, as you think of rest from the standpoint of parents. If we have children to rear, the Sabbath day sometimes is a very, very busy day. Most of the time, it's a busy day.
Well,
but it's busy with the things that actually are the high peak of the entire week. And it then the child, certainly, Sabbath, school, and church service and the whole thing is a part of this.
What this question is asking is teaching them righteousness by faith, and it seems to me the kernel of righteousness by faith is, for a little child, is I love Jesus so much, I want to do what he wants me to do, in simple childlike talk. And if parents live like this, it's kind of contagious.
And not only that, if you talked about the fact that we're never going to be that's how they're going to Jesus.
Correct.
That's right. Yes, as I am such a loving, lovable parent, and so on. Jackie had her hand up.
Jackie.
I find, too, that it's very important how I phrase things. If we say it, it makes it sound like we're earning our way, or we're doing these things, but, oftentimes I find the words starting to come out like they used to come out,
Say it right. You know, I really think we... We ought to get this tape that Susan is talking about. We had, it really is just excellent on this, and our children's leaders and our children's divisions are really trying hard to teach this philosophy of righteousness by faith.
This
and we could benefit by that. Okay, certainly. The next question in this section, teaching children to pray. There's the child guidance, the whole section in child guidance in this section, I think. Does anyone have suggestions about teaching children to pray? It seems to me, of course, different families are different ways. I think conversational prayer is a very nice way to teach little children to pray. If any of you have used that in your home, get your Bonnie.
So, I'm having a difficulty with that right now, too, with the children praying. But one thing that we're trying right now, and I don't know if it will work, maybe is to stop and think before they speak and go over the game. And I don't know why, but it's so difficult for some children, especially to relate to an intangible thing. I just try to say it's no different from talking to mommy and daddy. But anyhow, the thing with how to stop and think and
really think
the day, take out the things that you really are happy.
It's a very good.
I think that one of the best ways of doing this in reality is to actually lead the child day by day into a knowledge of the fact that God and you are partners in every experience of the entire day. It's the most of the time, the reason why it is difficult for a child to pray is because the child hears the parent talk about God only when he's either in trouble or some catastrophe or something of this kind has happened, or it's on Sabbath.
Not as much in Adventist home.
Well, it still is. It still is a lot. And but actually, if actually God is an integral part of your preparation of food, of your vacuuming the house, of every solitary thing that you do, you say, if you talk about God in the common things of life, then the child has something to pray about. You're not, you don't come to a point and say, well, man, I don't need anything. I haven't done anything bad, so why should I talk to God? And this is the tragedy. But if God is real in every experience,
that's
and
true,
you have him there, and the child sees that you trust him in all of your activities, then prayer becomes a very personal thing. Yes, Susan.
I was just thinking of my own mother's example. See, I remember many times when I was little that something would work out for her, and I might not even know what it was, because it would be solved in her mind, or maybe it was something that I could see that was solved, and she'd say out loud while she was doing dishes or something, thank you, Lord, and then she'd be worried about something, and she'd say, Lord, you'll have to help me out. She'd just talk out loud, not knowing
good who training.
Was around or who was listening, and it was all the time that way.
And to a friend.
Hymn book up, and she memorized the hymns while she was doing dishes. That was just part of your life all the time.
Like Mrs. White says, we should be talking to a friend.
Certainly. The thing is that, have you ever noticed that if a little child normally is left alone, and a little child loses a little doll dress, what do?
Pray.
Sure. But, the parents, instead of really, most of the time, really entering into this with a child, we refer to it, you know, kind of, as though it's a little bit, you know, well, it's just kind of, you know, it's a simple little thing. And when you're an adult, you don't do that.
Sure.
But I'll tell you, I've lost many things and simply said, Lord, I don't know where it is. You'll have to find it, and you'll have to show it to me, wherever it is. And invariably, I turn around and there it is in front of me. Or, you know, I mean, it's a very, I think that we definitely need to capitalize upon the natural inclination of a child. And not make that. We have a tendency in our adult minds to divide the child and God. We need to make this closer and draw this relationship closer and closer, because the child is naturally inclined that way. But they get the idea that parents, you see, adults get farther and farther and farther away and only have God for special times and special seasons and, you know, special events.
That's the example again of parents. This is the. We'll get right back to that. Okay, let's take this one question here I think is quite thought-provoking. I am overwhelmed with the way society gears everything to thrilling and pleasing the self-life and the child. How do we go about teaching the child that everything revolves about Christ living in us? The child is born thinking and caring only about himself. How do we help him to understand dying to self? It seems so difficult, and so I think you remember the rest of that. But I think this is quite a thought-provoking question. Let's think. Marion. That's right. Mm-hmm. To take to somebody, I know. That's right. I know some mothers that are doing that in our church. Jenna.
I think something else is maybe trying to get children. That's my natural activity.
Definitely.
All
the artificial.
So artificial. All the toys. It's important to get our children to not do it with them. You know, they're doing all these things that we're doing.
They're so
peaceful. And
they play it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's an excellent idea.
Most children have 10 times more.
So poverty stricken when our children were little that the poor little kids didn't have any toys because there weren't any toys, and we had all kinds.
There were things
that we found in the woods and little jars and bottles and this type of thing that we had our little playhouses, and it was no curse to them. But I think also that when children live in a home where they see selflessness in their parents. That, yes, they do learn selfishness from adults. But if parents are quite selfless, and you know, as families we are, you know, generous and doing kind things for others, children, you know, get their minds directed a little bit away from it. But I can't remember where the statement in Sister White's writings are about not making children the center. I think that some homes, you go to the home and the child is the center of this home. Everything revolves around this child. And it's hard for some parents to get the balance between, we speak about, now this is your life work, this is the thing you ought to be concentrating on, which is true, but also, then there are parents who have this thought who everything revolves around the child, which teaches selfishness. So to get this balance between really being in dead earnest about bringing them up right and paying much attention to their care and training, and at the same time not having them the center, it's a joy to go to a home where children know their place. And children are not the very center of everything. And when adults are conversing and so on, the children are not, you know, right in the middle of all the goings on. And I think there's a fine line here that is being brought out in this question, I believe. I think that's part of the question here of this. And of course, how do we teach a child to die to self? Since the day is going to come when they're truly converted, this must happen.
This is the will. This is what we've been talking
about. That's what we're talking about.
This is exactly how it's done.
That's pretty well covered then.
The training of the will is the only way that this can be done in a child before the years of accountability.
That's right.
The only way you can train the will is by dying yourself.
Correct. But you see...
Does that help? I mean...
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the thing really is so very important that we get our own mind straightened out and realize that this is not a matter of emotionalism. It is not a matter of getting the child's emotions stirred up and they surrendering, you say, to Christ or anything like this. That is so easy to do. It is so easy to persuade a child by telling them some emotional story to get them to do this or that. But that's not what it's talking about at all, in any sense of the word. Emotionalism is not the thing. It is a matter of actually training the will so that the child actually has the desire to really put himself in the hands of the superior will.
That's right.
It's
when they're little, and then they learn to transfer that over to God when they come to the age of accountability.
Yes, it's like that story in, of Ann Landers here, where she tells her own experience of her own child when she was 13 or 14 years of age, and she came to her mother and asked her if she could go to the could fly to the college dance. And her mother said, no. You're not anywhere near old enough for that kind of activity. She said, her daughter turned around to her and said, well, I didn't think so either, but I thought I'd try.
Okay. All right, now let's take the section on parenthood. There's two questions left on the section on parenthood. One is, how can father and mother agree on the right way of punishing the child? That might be a little sticky to get that one arranged. The other question in that section is, what is the importance of specific roles of father and mother? How does the blurring of these roles affect the child? Let's take the first one first. How can mother and father agree on the right way of punishing the child? Page 239 in Child Guidance, I'll just read this little bit here and then we can talk about it. The mother should ever have the cooperation of the father in her efforts to lay the foundation of a good Christian character in her children. A doting father should not close his eyes to the faults of his children because it is not pleasant to administer correction. Right principles must be established in the mind of the child. If the parents are united in this work of discipline, the child will understand what is required of him. But if the father, by word or look, shows that he does not approve of the discipline the mother gives, if he feels that she is too strict and thinks that he must make up for the harshness by petting and indulgence, the child will be ruined. Deception will be practiced by the sympathizing parents, and the child will soon learn that he can do as he pleases. Parents who are committing this sin against their children are accountable for the ruin of their souls. Wow, that's really potent, isn't it? So how do we get agreed?
Seems like one of the things I can read too in scripture is just a disaster. There's boundaries.
Oh,
there might be sometimes that even when it doesn't look like a very bad situation, that sometimes if you agree to disagree, it should be something else.
I think that's absolutely.
Have you ever seen a child pit mother against dad?
Oh, done it. I've been the child.
Well, that is so true. But I still feel like the Lord made mothers and fathers from the standpoint that father may be a little more stern than mother, or vice versa. It can sometimes be the other way in a family, but basically underneath there should always be this understanding between mother and dad that has been decided off in the anteroom, not in front of the children. Now look, when you are disciplining the children, even though I don't like what you're doing, I am going to keep my mouth shut, and to all appearances it's going to be agreeing with you. And father say the same to mother. Then if there's any discussing and I don't like the way you did it, I will say it in the dark room, away from the hearing of my children. But we have a united front to the children. Otherwise, we will do what she says. Our children, we're going to be accountable for the ruin of their souls. It's just terrible. This is one of the worst things we can do.
That's right.
Is parents to disagree in public, in front of their children. And for what, for the child to feel like, oh, I can get away with murder with this one and I can't with that one, it's really a catastrophe. Tell us how you do it, how you get agreed. Other people. Susan. You have agreed, I take it.
Well, it's still somewhat of a problem with me, but
Gary, it's real good. No, but I know that one thing, if the child goes to him and he says no, and then they come to me and I'm on my toes, I can reinforce his no and still be going to God.
Sure.
I think Gary said no, and not through, and you have to obey
him. And mother agrees.
So there's a good reason for it. You don't have to be stern with him. You can take it easy.
Mm-hmm. You're supporting. It certainly is true.
You don't know that Daddy said no.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's another situation all over again. And when you do find out,
then let's get agreeable. But I, parents need to, both mother and father need to have this seriously thought of, that that we do no discussing of how we're going to get agreed in front of the children. We present a united front.
Tell us.
It's a bit of a problem, though, is that mother's with the kids all day.
Yes.
Daddy comes home at night, and, you know, I didn't realize that we're saying the same thing all the time.
That's right. But if it's been understood in privacy that when I come home at night, I'm Daddy now, when I come home at night and I see you handling a situation, I'm not going to talk about it in front of the children. I may get you in a corner and really tell you how you don't do it right, but we'll get it agreed behind the children's back.
It doesn't hurt, I don't think. Like, when I come home sometimes, I don't know what's going on, and she's out in the kitchen, you step out there and say, what's the policy? I mean, it doesn't hurt that.
Well, pretty cute.
Now,
Bobby,
that's the voice of experience.
Go ahead, Bossy, you may speak.
The rebuttal?
Well, it's something that I appreciate, because he'll come in and he'll whisper to me, now say, what's the policy? Might be jumping off the back of the couch. That was all right.
Yeah.
Anyway, at least he lets me.
Yeah, you're together. As far as the children can see, mother and dad are together. That's
great.
He just
doesn't say anything until he knows.
Yeah. My, you're terrific, Bill. I didn't know how great you were. Anybody else got something to say on this?
Done.
We've run across this problem occasionally, and say there's been a deal between child and mother that dad has come about and cut down for a hand, and all the earth breaks loose.
Well, I say just
for
that, now just wait and let's replay this thing. So in front of her, okay, now Jeff, this is really, you know, he came in and jumped on all fours. She's saying what for, and I don't think we should really hear this. So everything stops in front of her, and we replay the thing to see if my brother.
So Daddy gets the picture. Daddy
gets the whole picture there, and so she can see why we're doing.
Once I know what the deal is, why I'll.
Then you cooperate.
And, we'll do it.
Oh, you're even greater than I thought you were, too. Absolutely.
This is where justice and mercy blend together.
But
always.
I tell you,
always.
This mother and daddy business of getting together, I think that's, next in importance to the, I don't know, next in importance, but it's very, very important. It's a tremendously important thing for children. And when children get this feeling that mother and daddy are not agreeing, it's not only about their discipline, but about other things. It's, where did we read this? That the greatest gift that a father can give to his children is to love their mother. And the greatest gift that a mother can give to her children is to love their father. And I'll tell you, if we all did that, we wouldn't have hardly any problems at all with our children. It's a tremendous influence.
This comes in such a small and insidious way, because you just take, for instance, at the dining room table. And mother sets some food in front of Junior and says, now eat it. And Junior, gets dangling along and playing along. And finally, Dad pipes up and he says, well, you eat part of it, And it's just trimmed down just a little bit, but that's the edge, and that's the thing that Junior piles into, and he
takes advantage.
He takes advantage of that because he's much more clever than you ever dreamed.
So usually six jumps ahead of the candy,
you Comfort under stress when you read that the mother should never raise her voice because you notice she didn't say the fuck.
Oh man, I've got to get busy and find something here.
Yeah, then he'd rather just stay any place that
you're going to be pinning to the floor.
this morning, we had a situation this morning. We happened to be with grandparents and aunts and uncles and adoring cousins. And wow, by this morning, we had a 5-year-old who was loving to sit to live with. And he raised his voice and his hand. And, well, yes, raised his hand. And Daddy came in and said, I am never going to speak to you. And I'm like, no.
So she could see the fairness of it before it was over.
Is it, I mean, in this fairness thing, I mean, is it ever,
Well, I think it depends on how the voice is raised. In my estimation, there's ways of raising your voice. If you're screaming mad, but I've heard my husband and other men that I respect in a very good, loud, well-heard voice tell what ought to be done. And not, you know, screaming in a rage of temper, but
I
doesn't have oil. That is right. My kids, I'll tell you, they knew that when Father spoke in that voice, now is the time to act and not later, right now.
You brought out a little bit earlier about the fact that maybe we should delay our actions sometimes. I was thinking of this morning, it's kind of related to anything, and it had been brewing for quite a while, and I just very firmly took a hold of her arm and let her in the room and gave her a crank there on the spot, because she openly denied everything that I had said for about 5 minutes in a soft voice, trying to get her to do what her mother had asked her to do. And I think she understood perfectly well what was going on.
You're talking about, in other words, there you didn't take a lot of time. Personally, I think there's times, and Sister White says
absolutely.
It, and there's other places, there's times when right now is the time to do this fat, not a long discussion. Sweet, I'm smiling while I do it, but now is the time you're going to be smitten, and vigorous, hard.
Now you're smitten with...
Okay, well, now one more question on the parenthood section, and this is one that I think we can really have fun with. the importance of the specific roles of father and mother. How does the blurring of these roles affect the child? Before we talk, I want to read a little thing in this book, Christian Family, that I think is pretty good. It's just oodles of good stuff in here, but I can't read it all this in time. But anyway, Dr. Bruno Bettelheim, that's really a name, noted psychologist and author, says, in countless families, the father is merely mother's little helper. She exhorts him, why don't you change the baby? How about feeding while I go shopping? Get him dressed. I'm busy. It's condoned by many family experts. They urge today's father to be a part-time nursemaid so that he will be emotionally enriched as mother is. But this is foolish advice. Male physiology and psychology aren't geared to it. Not that there's anything wrong with a father occasionally giving baby a bottle if the situation requires it or he enjoys it. What's wrong is thinking that it adds to his parenthood. When a man tries to be a better father by acting like a mother, he is not only less fulfilled as a father, but as a man, too. A father's relationship with his children can't be built mainly around child-caring experiences. If it is, he's a substitute mother, not a father. Similarly, under this petticoat rule, if a tired father is bludgeoned into serving as a kitchen aide, I'm really going to charge all this bludgeoned into it, as a kitchen aide and handyman, it doesn't enrich his fatherhood either. Actually, a wife who shifts her unpleasant household chores to her husband is downgrading her own activities in her children's eyes. Many well-intentioned fathers turn over their paychecks to their wives, who then give them an allowance, pretty much as a child gets one. This mother knows best practice shows that a husband thinks highly of his wife, but it also implies to a child that Pop is just another silly boy child in the family. This blurring of mother-father roles can have harmful effects on children. Because many fathers now wash dishes, bathe the baby, perform other traditional female tasks, their sons often don't know what it means to be a man. If mother and father do the same chores, a child doesn't have a clear father or mother image. No wonder so many boys and girls are mixed up about their roles in later life. It is the responsibility of both partners in a marriage to see that the husband and wife roles do not become confused. Men have been as guilty of abdicating their role as head of the home as women have been of usurping it. It is not easy to remain submissive to one who palms off his responsibilities upon you and refuses to take the lead in family affairs. The emancipation of women has brought many needed reforms, but it had the unfortunate side result of robbing women of securities and protection, which are her right. Women today are put upon to shoulder financial problems and worries in the family, to spearhead civic programs, to take the lead in raising the children, to represent the family of the community, to make major family decisions, to be the spiritual leader in the family. All this is contrary to divine order.
Amen.
A woman is not normally equipped by nature to sustain this kind of physiological and psychological and emotional pressure and still fulfill her God-appointed role as wife and mother. The fact that women can do some of these things with technical competence only camouflages the irreparable damage to women, to family, to society of this departure from divine order. The church has not been the least to suffer from this trend toward the feminization of our culture. As men have abdicated their role as the spiritual heads of their families, more and more of the responsibility in the church has fallen upon the women, so on and so on. I won't read more of that, but I thought that was pretty good on that. No, and I can't agree more. Has anybody seen the little magazine called Hers? Well, it's put out by a lady who is a seventh. I showed it to some of you. I don't remember who all got a hold of it, but it's put out by.
You shouldn't even talk.
I won't name. My husband doesn't like it at all. I won't name the lady, but anyway, it's, you know, through the denomination, it's come out here, and I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been quite a trend. We don't need to really go into that here, but there's quite a trend, even within the denomination, you know, among employees of the denomination, let's get women recognized more, and let's ordain women to be ministers and all this stuff. It's going to come out.
It's a journal.
It's going to come out probably like four times a year, I think it is. Well, it's a group. It's a group behind it. No, it's done by an individual, by a group that is not exactly what you would call denominationally sponsored. Thanks the Lord. Thanks the Lord, it isn't. I'd be ashamed if it were. But anyway, let's get to the topic here now. And this book, The Christian Family, has just all kinds of things on this. When it speaks of, you know, talking about getting the roles mixed up, this whole section in here, The Christian Family, on God's order for husbands and God's order for wives, I'll tell you, it's just really, really very good, and it certainly tells what a man ought to be doing in his home and what a woman ought to be doing. But the question here was, in importance of specific roles of father and mother, and how does the blurring of these roles affect the children? Now, we've covered some of it here, but let's talk about it. How do you all feel?
Wanda?
When I was born, I was up in Washington, and that was my son. When he came home, he did everything for that child. I had a glass of pressure. And I don't think that changing her diaper changing her diaper and bathing her all gifts made him less of a father.
Well, that isn't what the book is saying either. The book isn't saying that. It's talking about bludgeoning them into this and men being the little nursemaids. But a father, my husband, did all kinds of things for our babies too. He loved them. He wanted to. But it wasn't that I stepped aside and he took over the mother role. You know, I think there's a difference in a man, you know.
I know that there have been some men that see Alan change the baby
Oh, well, I don't think that's what this book is saying either. I didn't get that at all. I don't believe that is the case, but, Bossy.
I think the son is the kind that is bothered by changing the baby. He shouldn't be forced.
Well, that's what the book is saying. A man should be.
Well, whether he's, I think whether he's bothered or not, I think that for the real problem that is brought up here is the fact that sometimes mothers want to simply shy away from and pawn off their responsibility to a dick.
That's right.
And this is the real psychological problem that it creates.
Yes,
it isn't that the father is so much if he's forced into this thing, it really does have a great psychological problem.
Well, I don't know exactly what to say about this. I just know that in our house, it's sort of an easy flow back and forth. I mean, there's really no cut and dry outline. If the boys are in the cabin, for some reason, I call the girl, Jim goes up and bathes them.
Mm-hmm.
Or if something needs to be done, the other one isn't available to take care of, the other one isn't messing it up, stepping over to maybe a female-oriented role or a male-oriented role. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know.
Yeah.
I have a very wonderful husband. I mean, he's just not, I don't know, he's just, he's good to me. And if you have good communication and if you have a good relationship, it's not...
A cut and dried role. Well, I don't think that's what this book is saying either. And I, this is just an example. But you know, I think that it's really what it's really talking about is where a woman honestly becomes the head of the house. I mean, where there really is switching of role. And it isn't talking about the little things like changing baby diapers and a few other things. My husband was a jewel when my babies were little. He would leap out of bed and change the diapers.
But
what did I say? He'd leap out of bed and change the diapers and bring the babies back to be nursed and take them back and put them to bed. Wasn't that remarkable?
Yeah, that's just...
And still, he didn't by any manner of means think that I had become the head of the house.
I think the real thing that makes Larry Christensen write this way is because there definitely is a intermingling and a switching of roles today. And this is because of, partially because of the society that we live in. The whole situation, you just can't imagine that a situation of this would have existed to any degree on the frontier.
Yeah, the men are out whacking down the trees.
You know, how a fella come in and packing a six, you know, gun, you know, and doing this type of thing. It just then men were rugged. Today, we live in a very sophisticated world in which men's roles have changed, and so there is a very great temptation to switch this also within the family circle. One needs to be careful because a man still needs to be a man and retain his masculinity, and a woman needs to be a woman and retain her femininity.
Be a fascinating woman, in other words. Another thing that I think would be a good time to mention right here, and we don't have, I was going to do a lot of research on this and have it ready for the class, which I haven't done. I've read quite a bit on it in the past, but I'm sure all of you have. The homosexuality problem that we face in this generation is, you know, they definitely lay it to this very fact that father has no longer been the man
subjective.
And the head. This is really what has brought on this terrible rash of homosexuality. And there's just been a lot of research and writing done on this, that whenever a father backs up and lets mother be the leader, and the children sense this, there's a terrible damage done to children. Along this line, that as I say, I had really hoped to have time to go to, you know, libraries and do a lot of reading on this, but I didn't get around to it. But I, you know, we have done quite a little reading in the past on it, and I know that, you know, we've dealt with a few families that have had some problem, and this is exactly where it is written. And so that is another reason we need to be careful. With the homosexual problem, well, I'm sure it enters into it. But I think actually that the problem of men no longer being men in their homes and this kind of a example set to children, and there's been a lot written on this in recent years. A lot has been written on it and research done on it. Well, now we are to the stage of the questions that we're going to start through the miscellaneous questions. We have like about 30 of them. So we covered the one question, how to be consistent. Now let's take question number 2 in the miscellaneous group. Should we allow teenagers to remain in our home when they choose to live contrary to house rules? This ought to be interesting.
I remember, and I'm no authority, I just remember something I read in Child Guidance. Now, it sounded a little harsh the first time I read it. So, what you did,
I tell you, this could be very controversial.
You've got a problem here. You've got to realize the age. 14-year-old kid that
This is should we
not going to abide by the rules, he can't live on his own.
Should we allow teenagers to remain in our home when they choose to live contrary to house rules? And I think we ought to think what the question is. What it really is.
Something's gone wrong in the first place for them to choose that way.
Well, yeah, that's right. But here we are. The thing we're at hand, we're being asked here, should we allow them to stay home when they are not lining up to house rules? I'd love to hear some discussion. Let's hear some people out here.
Our house rules are always right.
Are they? Well, let's...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what do you think? What do we think we ought to do? Let's hear some people. Don. I'm just dying to talk about this, but I'm not going to answer it.
I think maybe with parents, as long as, I mean, he lives the way he wants to live, as long as you don't do these things in the home, like smoking and stuff, then I shouldn't let him do much.
Okay, let's hear another opinion. Lee?
God doesn't reject us, but then by the same token, he doesn't save us either. We don't want to line up the way his rules are.
Okay, anybody else have an opinion on that? What would you do if it were your child, your teenager? Your teenager. Now here it is. Let's just put it to ourselves. My teenager is not living up to the house rules. Do I kick him out? Bonnie.
Well, I have a sister that, this is a problem my family's having with her right now, and they just, they didn't figure out my folks have weighed in the balance both ways, They've read this child by himself. So yet, are you going to force them out into a situation that might be their problem worse, or you sort of compromise a little bit? Not like she smokes. Well, there's no smoking in the house. That's it. You're going to stay at home. So that's what's down.
Okay. Anybody else have a thought? Luther?
So far, your replies have been returning the question to you.
Now, I'm dying to talk, but I want to hear everybody else say
something. I'm going to try and get this off a high standard here. And let's say that this would be a possible answer to your question. And that would be to carefully, and of course prayerfully, before and during and after, talk with the child involved. Tell them, even if you have to write out a basic list of a minimal, just as small a list as possible to make it palatable, that are what the parent feels are fundamental house rules. They're not going to a whole lot of little
peripheral
that'll just make it impossible. But have certain basic rules and then present them either in written or in so thorough communicated rules that they understand. Talk it over on a communication basis.
Are you saying that these rules are given to them and you live up to them, or you go out? Is this what you're saying?
Well,
basically,
you're talking with them and tell them that this.
Yeah, but I mean, you have talked it over thoroughly with them, and you've presented these kindly thought through rules,
yeah.
And then you say,
then
if you don't live up to these, you go out. Are you, is that
no,
what you're saying?
No, you're taking words out of
my mouth. I'm asking you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you communicate with the child and tell them these are the house rules here at this home. And here's the reason why, and elaborate on that. And then say, don't answer me now, but take these and think about them. And see if it would be compatible to make them your house rules while you're here. And then come back again and let's talk about it. Then if the child says, I cannot stay here and live by these.
Then what?
Then I think it has to be treated as rebellion.
What, when they rebel, then what?
Well, what did Jesus, how did God treat Lucifer when he rebelled?
Okay, oh, goody-goody hand. Ingalls.
Well, I think this is a really awfully broad question. It's each case each one is an individual case of its own. And I can think of my own case in my life when I stayed at home. I stayed at home, I think, five and a half years that I should have, And my parents probably should have kicked me out of home a lot sooner. But I don't think that's I think it's hard to answer that.
Okay, Wanda?
I was just thinking of an uncle that I have, kids that were about my age, and they're not Christian, not agnostic, I guess. But that wall tear got him a bit. A lot of times, he didn't even want to get out of the wall. And we're afraid to let them go. But they let Walt go. And a week or so later, he called back and he wanted to talk to his mom. And one time, he come home and she said, go talk to dad. And his dad wasn't pleased to talk to, but we found out that it wasn't so fun to wash his own clothes. And he was on cooking, and that he didn't like the other fellow's cooking. The other fellow didn't wash his clothes either.
Mm-hmm. Home seemed kind of nice. Jackie? Excuse me.
Can you read the question again?
All right. That's what I've been thinking too. Should we allow teenagers to remain in our home when they choose to live contrary to house rules?
Maybe. I think this is in the wrong place. I mean, a family is a family, and I don't know, to me, the answer is...
Say what you're thinking.
I'm trying, but I don't want, it's just a feeling I have. The emphasis should not be on, it's almost like there are two entities here.
Mm-hmm.
And really, a family is a unit, and mm-hmm. it's the way the family organized. You know, I don't know.
All right, that's a good opinion. Janice?
It doesn't answer that question, except that more often than that, it's going to be the child wants to leave, isn't it?
I don't know. Well, I'm not. Well, this question is not talking about a child who wants to leave. This question is talking about parents' attitude when they do not abide by the rules. Vimic?
What Luther was bringing up here, it seems to me like he had a good point he was making. If the child, after communicating to the child, these simple and few rules. That are the house rules, rather than my kicking that child out, if the child understands that these are the rules and he's expected to obey them, then if he does choose to leave, it would be his own choice. And
okay.
He is leaving.
Okay.
Maybe
Daddy
doesn't feel like coming
to work and working every day. Then he goes. Maybe
we don't all feel like
doing something.
This is our job. This is, by everybody working together, doing all these things for this unit.
Yeah, I agree.
I know the approach I've always taken is, you know, look, we are a unit, and let's get to the root of the problem and work out the problem and learn to function together rather than...
Mm-hmm.
It's a split between the student and that question.
It bothers me, too.
Would it make some kind of a difference, too, about the child conduct is, and if there's other children in the home, that's going to affect him.
Okay, anybody else have a thought? Well, we've got about 2 minutes left, and I'd have to share and make my speech.
Well, let's hear your speech.
Okay, shall I make mine first, then you make yours, or do you care?
Well, do you want to have the last word?
No, I will have the first word. I want the first word. Well, I'll tell you, this question, I don't have any idea who put it in, so I'm not hitting at anybody. But I'll tell you, as far as I'm concerned, I just can't imagine asking my child to leave home, ever, under any circumstances. If my child is going to smoke, or my child's going to drink, or my child's going to do whatever, I couldn't any more ask my child to leave home than I could fly. And I feel like that the thing I ought to be doing, if the thing rose like this, that they are not living to the house rules. Well, good night, that could be going on from the time they're 5 years old. They're not living up to the house rules. What are the house rules? And, am I going to remove them when they don't live up to all of the house rules? I'd be removed too then, because I don't always live up to the house rules either. And so that's my opinion, that I am not about to kick out my teenager, and I just don't feel like it ever should be done. And I don't think I should... they pretty well know the rules of the home. If we are running a family, we're a unit, we pretty well know And I don't feel they should ever be brought, look here now, are you going to line up to these things that we do here, or aren't you? I really don't feel like I could ever do that. Janet?
The counsel that I had read in that child guidance was more on the other,
when they want to go.
I want to go.
Why don't you say your speech? Okay.
I wanted to ask Dorothy how you can align this thinking to the beautiful Garden of Eden experience.
Well, I'm not God.
But you
that's how I align it.
In the home
but I don't have the authority, that kind of authority. I don't believe I have that kind of authority to remove my child from the home. I really don't. I just don't do it. Pardon?
There might be an age consideration.
Well, I think that maybe we are, you know, some of us who you know maybe differ on this, let's do a little reading. I'll see if you could find anything that would make it so that anywhere I could ever read that we should put our children out of our home. I haven't read it, and it may be there. I just don't know. You know, we've got about 2 minutes, and it's 9 o'clock, so...
You expect me to...
Say your speech.
Give my opinion in 2 minutes?
No, but make it as fast
never.
As you can.
Never. I think that actually... basically, the problem that exists in any situation of this kind, and again, I haven't any idea who put this question in, but if this is a real problem or if it isn't, wherever it might be a problem, it is a problem that is created by the parents in the first place. And the child who is undisciplined is not responsible, but the parents are actually responsible. And I do not think that it is ever proper to allow a child of any age to show the disrespect of refusing to cooperate. But I think that the process of bringing them into cooperation is an extremely delicate one when a child reaches the age of accountability and on. And it gets more difficult and more difficult the older a child gets, and therefore requires much more tact than at any other time. Now notice, lax discipline and its fruitage. The... We note on page 275 of Child Guidance, a woe rests upon parents who have not trained their children to be God-fearing, but have allowed them to grow to manhood and womanhood undisciplined and uncontrolled. During their own childhood, they were allowed to manifest passions and willfulness and to act from impulse. And they bring this same spirit into their own homes. They are defective in temper and passionate in government. Even there, in their acceptance of Christ, they have not overcome the passions that were allowed to rule in their childish hearts. They carry the results of their early training, that's early training, through their entire religious life. It is a most difficult thing to remove the impress thus made upon the plant of the Lord, for as the twig is bent, the tree is inclined. That's why we just stress so very definitely, and when we talk about teenagers, you're talking about a situation that is obviously many, many years beyond where the training really should come. Now, on the other hand, the last part of this page and the next page, 276, when parents sanction and thus perpetuate the wrongs in their children, as did Eli, God will surely bring them to the place where they will see that they have not only ruined their own influence, but also the influence of the youth whom they should have restrained. Now, just be quiet. I was quiet while you talked.
Okay. It's terribly hard to do.
They will have bitter lessons to learn. Oh, that the Elis of today, who are everywhere to be found pleading excuses for the waywardness of their children would promptly assert their own God-given authority to restrain and correct them. It is not the place of parents to just get rid of the problem by casting them out. It is not the place of the parents either, however, to simply excuse this and tolerate it. This is neither position. Let parents and guardians who overlook and excuse sin in those under their care remember that they thus become accessory to these wrongs. Now, the problem with Eli was not that the fact that his sons were evil. The problem with Eli was the fact that he did nothing to correct them. Now, God does not condemn a parent who has neglected the rearing of their child in the time when their characters were formative. But actually, God condemns the parent who, after those years, and the child is rebellious, does not try and do anything to correct them, but rather just indulges them and becomes in reality an accessory. And I think that this is absolutely one of the most sad pictures. Read again the story of Eli and of Samuel. And both of these men absolutely just, it tears your heart out to see what they tolerated and excused in their children. And if I ever get to the point in my parenthood where I excuse the evils that I myself have actually put into a child by tolerance, by misguidance, I am then an accessory to that child's wrong. And I must face this as a fact. And I think that if I have this kind of a situation, you have one of the most difficult situations to possibly face, but God is still there, and God will help. If instead of unlimited indulgence, the chastening rod were oftener used not in passion, but with love and prayer, we would see happier families and a better state of society. Now, this is, of course, going back to the child when the child is still not. The neglect of Eli is brought plainly before every father and mother in the land as the result of his unsanctified affection. And I like that term. Unsanctified affection, and we have lots of parents who have unsanctified affection, or his unwillingness to do a disagreeable duty. He reaped a harvest of iniquity in his perverse sons. Both the parent who permitted the wickedness and the children who practiced it were guilty before God, and he would accept no sacrifice or offering for their transgression. That's probably the strongest language that you can possibly read. But it does not in any way say that you can shun this by simply kicking the child out. Because this is only becoming, in reality, one who shirks the responsibility of trying to do all that it's possible to do to correct that which you neglected to do before. Eli, if Eli had stood up on his hind feet and simply got those two sons and administered to them some very sound fatherly counsel and stood firm, the boys probably wouldn't have gotten themselves into the mess that they got into.
That's right. Before we stop here, I'd just like to mention, since we're talking about teenagers, this book, What's a Parent to Do, dealing with this very thing of strenuous teenagers. And he has some really wise counsel in here that is justice and mercy. He has some theological errors, but he really has
Yes, this man has some weird theology. But he writes this book on the basis of the fact that you are dealing with a rebellious, ornery child that is in the...
Out of control.
Out of control and dope and all of this sort of thing. And what do you do with him?
It's and really tremendous. It's worth
he really has done a good job, but his theology is very, very weird.
Well,
all right, our time is up. 4 minutes over. We're sorry we kept you that extra 4 minutes, but it's time to bring our meeting to a close tonight. And as we do, let's just stand and we'll ask Don. Don, would you offer a closing prayer? If I can get my foot out from this chair. Okay.
Father in heaven, this evening our hearts have been stirred as we have sat here and discussed the problems of raising our children. We ask thy guidance and direction now as we go our way and help us in the coming weeks to push back to the things we go here. Be with each one in this room and all that can be here.
Amen.
You can find the rest of the sermons of this series on the World Wide Web at www.justifiedwalk.com. By writing to Justified Walk, 5574 Deans Hill Road, Berrien Springs, Michigan, 49103, or calling 269-471-9224. You will discover two more series of sermons at the website, one entitled The Justified Walk, of which the third sermon has been listened to by thousands of people. You can also find all the handouts that go with that series. You'll also find a six-part series of sermons entitled The Branch and the Vine, which is a wonderful study on fruit-bearing in the Christian life. In addition to the audio and related handout resources on the web, you will also find Pastor Philip's book, His Robe or Mine. This book is proving life-changing for many, and we urge you to read it. You can read it on the website, download it as a PDF file for easy printing, or contact Justified Walk Ministries to obtain a copy of your own. We believe the self-denying path to victory message shared by Pastor Phillips needs to be developed for children, young adults, families, and married couples, and are accordingly developing appropriate resources and will make them available as quickly as possible. So be looking for those on our website as well. We also are having transcripts of Pastor Phillips' sermons and his book translated into other languages, and will make them available at the same place. Have you been blessed by these materials? Do you want to share them with others and feel a sense of urgency to get them out as quickly as possible? Here are ways you can help us do that. First, pray for the ministry. Then, copy the materials, CDs, the handouts, etc., and share them with others. Tell others about where to find the materials on the web. Take it upon yourself to introduce the materials, the book, the tapes, to your pastor and encourage your church to study them. You can also volunteer your help in a production-related task or in creatively developing materials or supporting that creative process. And last but not least, generously supporting the ministry financially as God directs you. We take the verse, "Freely have you received, freely give seriously," and thus try to make these materials available as inexpensively as possible, and in many cases for free. Needless to say, donations to extend this not-for-profit ministry are needed and appreciated. Once again, materials can be obtained via the web at www.justifiedwalk.com, through the mail at Justified Walk, 5574 Deans Hill Road, Berrien Springs, Michigan, 49103, or by calling 269-471-9224.